It reminded her of being 14 and in love with a one-legged boy at the neighboring school. Giles was kind to her, as he was to all the girls who adored him. And the patient, distracted expression he got on his face while Ellen babbled on at the railway station, trying desperately to make some sort of impression before the 3:45 train arrived, was identical to the one on Jack's face. It said, "I couldn't care less, really, but I'm a nice person and I don't want to hurt your feelings, so I'm just going to keep smiling until you stop talking." And it was even worse when she tried to play it cool, to act as if she didn't care what Jack thought of her, because he was so self-contained, so busy with his own life, that he really did just completely forget about her existence. Which was exactly what used to happen with Giles, too. Well, this was what she had signed up for. She'd loved the idea of a stepchild, of an instant family. She should be happy that Patrick was treating her like a wife, and taking it for granted that she would be in charge of homework this afternoon. She should be focusing all her attention on poor little Jack, who had lost not one but two mothers by the age of five, and was probably suffering from terrible abandonment issues. "Yes!" shouted Jack, holding his computer game aloft. "Jesus," said Patrick, "don't kick the back of my seat." But shouldn't Patrick have checked with her first? Wasn't he taking advantage of her, to assume she'd be available? Of course, then again, she herself hadn't bothered to check with Patrick before she'd made the arrangement to have coffee with Julia, so she'd been acting like a single person too, like Jack wasn't her responsibility at all. It was so difficult to work out what was fair and what wasn't. Presumably, parents had some sort of procedure, an approval process when you were making arrangements. She'd have to ask her friend Madeline about this. "I thought you said you'd clear out all the boxes from the hallway this afternoon," said Ellen. Saturday had been taken up with Jack's sports activities, and Patrick had promised he'd have the boxes gone by the end of the weekend. "Oh, sure, don't worry," said Patrick. "When I get back from the office, I'll do it." He wouldn't. She knew he wouldn't. He'd be too tired after today's trip and then the office. It would be too late. Jack would want his attention when he got home, and then Patrick would want to collapse on the couch in front of 60 minutes. It would be mean to remind him then. It would be considered nagging. She would have to put up with another week of those boxes sitting in the hallway. All that clutter was having a catastrophic effect on the feng shui of her house. She seemed to remember that the front entrance was called the Mouth of Chi, where all the energy was meant to flow through. No wonder she was feeling so irritable. All the energy was being stopped at the front door. Of course, now was certainly not the time to push the issue of the boxes. Not when Patrick was so uptight about the lunch with Frank and Millie. But the words were as irresistible as the last chocolate in the box. "You won't move them," she murmured to the window, as if saying it quietly didn't really count. "What did you say?" Patrick spoke sharply. "Nothing." "Ellen, I just said I would move them." "So you did hear me." "Are you two fighting?" Jack asked with interest. So much for beautiful, poignant moments, thought Ellen. I decided I would spend the rest of Sunday watching television. A few months ago, Lance, who works in the office next to mine, lent me the series The Wire. He and his wife were always developing obsessions with TV series. And then he talks on and on about the fabulous character development and the amazing plot lines and the whatever. It's just television. I always want to say, "Look, Lance, I'm not that interested in television. I have a life." Ha! Good one. Such a pity that stalking isn't a socially acceptable hobby. For some reason, he insisted on lending me the series, even though I'm sure I showed minimal interest. He wants me to watch it so we can talk at length about each episode. I know this because he lent The West Wing to another girl in the office, and then every time he saw her, he wanted to know what episode she was up to so he could do an in-depth analysis. Eventually, she started hiding, leaping into nearby offices whenever she saw him coming down the corridor. So I was never going to bother watching it, and Lance has given up asking me if I've seen the pilot yet. But suddenly it seemed like the perfect way to swallow up a whole Sunday. I would eat toast and chocolate and try to let the rest of the day go by without even thinking of Patrick, Ellen, or Jack. I was even looking forward to it. But of course, like so many other things, it wasn't meant to be. When I drove into my driveway, the new family from next door was pulling in too, with impeccably horrible timing. They moved in on Friday, and they were just as bad as I knew they would be. A swinging ponytail mummy and a balding in a cool way daddy. A little girl with freckles and curls. A little boy with dimples. They're adorable and athletic, friendly and frisky. It's going to be like living next door to four Labradors. They introduced themselves and said they hoped they wouldn't be too noisy, and I must tell them if they are, and they must have me over for drinks sometime. I tried to be polite but standoffish, so they would know that none of this was necessary, that all that was required was a friendly wave. Jeff or the real estate agent should have explained this to them. The garage door sticks, garbage night is Monday, the neighbor doesn't require conversation. As soon as I got out of the car, they all came bounding over to me, their tongues hanging out, tails wagging. I nearly held up a palm to ward them off.
"Do you want to come over to our place this afternoon?"
asked the little girl. "Give Saskia a minute," said the mother, all loving laughter. She's at least 15 years younger than me, maybe more. I had no memory of her name. I hadn't even bothered to register it. They wanted to know if I would like to come over for a housewarming barbecue that afternoon. "Just a few friends," said the mother, "just very casual." "The next-door neighbor at our last house was called Mrs. Short," the little boy told me. "But she actually wasn't short. She was actually pretty tall." "Huh," I said. The boy reminded me a little of Jack, something about the eyes, maybe. Or perhaps it's just the age. He looks about 5, the same age as Jack was when Patrick and I broke up. I didn't want to make friends with him. Just looking at him made my chest hurt.
"Or even if you just want to stop by for a quick drink," suggested the father.
"We've got special sausages," said the little girl. "They've got chili in them."
"No pressure, don't feel obligated," said the mother. "We just thought, you know, if you didn't have anything else on, seeing as we're sort of sharing a house. We've never lived in a duplex before, so we thought, but of course you probably have other plans, or you might prefer just to relax on a Sunday."
She stopped, a little flustered. I saw her husband give her a look. They could sense my resistance and they were giving me a way out.
"They're nice. Nice, polite, ordinary people. That's all I need, to be living next door to nice people. They make me feel so inferior." So much for my day at home sedating myself with television. I told them I would have loved to join them, but I had another commitment that would take up most of the day. I overdid it with my regrets. I shouldn't have acted at all regretful.
"Another time," said the father.
"Another time," said the mother.
"Another time," said I.
"Another time," said the little boy.
And we all laughed oh so heartily, and the poor kid frowned because, after all, why was it funny when he said it?
"So fabulous. Now there will be another time."
I went inside and spent quite a lot of time preparing for my fake social obligation. I decided I was going to an old friend's 40th birthday party. It was just a casual but elegant event in her backyard. There would be lots of kids running about, and she was having it catered. I decided she was a well-off friend. In fact, her house actually backed onto the harbor, so the food would be good. I would be doing a speech. It would be funny and sentimental, the sort of speech that Ellen would do at a friend's 40th birthday party. I dressed in jeans, boots, a really beautiful blue top that Tammy had bought me for my birthday just before Mum died, that I'd never found the right occasion to wear. A 40th birthday by the harbor, perfect. And a long scarf that Mum had made for me. I knew that everyone at the party would compliment me on the scarf. My mother was very talented, I would tell them. I even blow-dried my hair and put on makeup and a pair of big earrings that Patrick always said made me look sexy. By the time I walked out the door, I was feeling the most attractive I'd felt in a long time. On impulse, I grabbed together the ingredients I'd bought for the Anzac biscuits and put them in a plastic bag. I decided I would drop them off at Ellen's front door on my way to the party. She could make biscuits. I was too busy with my active social life. As I walked to my car, a man and woman were walking up the driveway toward the neighbor's house for the housewarming barbecue. The man was holding a bottle of wine, and the woman was carrying a large plate wrapped in aluminium foil. I smiled at them and said, "Hi," as if I was a person too, a person off to a 40th birthday party on a Sunday. They smiled back. In fact, the man's smile seemed especially friendly, not at all perfunctory, almost like he knew me and was trying to place me, or almost as if, could it be, he found me attractive. "Coming over to the party?" he said.
"No, I've got another one to go to," I said. "A 40th.
Ah, well, have fun, he said at the same time as the neighbor's front door was opening and the next-door neighbors came out crying, Look who's here, and so you found us okay?
I went to my car quickly before they felt they had to introduce me. There was none of this awkwardness when Jeff lived next door. Neither of us ever had anyone over. As I turned on the ignition and waved goodbye, I saw the man was still watching me. He lifted his hand to wave goodbye and I felt a warm feeling, like the way I remembered happiness felt. I reversed out onto the street and glanced back, smiling, ready to wave again if someone caught my eye, and saw that none of them were looking at me. The woman was handing over the aluminium-wrapped plate, and as she did, I saw the man pulling her toward him, his hand on her hip in the same mock masterful way that Patrick used to do. And she was laughing up at him, and the little boy from next door was pulling at his free hand, wanting to point something out to him. The warm feeling vanished. He hadn't found me attractive at all. He was just one of those nice, friendly people who liked everyone. It made sense. The nice people next door would know other nice people. They tend to congregate. Or possibly he had found me attractive, but in a slimy, sleazy, I'm happy to cheat on my girlfriend if you're up for it way. He was probably the sort of man who smiled at every woman like that, just in case he was in with a chance. And then I thought, where the fuck am I going to go now? The 40th birthday party in the house by the harbour had begun to seem so real, I'd almost been looking forward to it. I had nowhere to go. Once upon a time, there were people I could have called. It's amazing how friends can slip through your fingers, how your social network can vanish like it never existed. If you don't have a family, if you live in a city designed so that you don't need to connect with anyone, and you drive everywhere, so there's nowhere to walk and nod hello, so you can do all your shopping in soulless supermarkets with blank-faced teenagers scanning your groceries, well, they look right through you as if you don't exist, because you don't. Not really. If I lived in a town like the ones I once wanted to design, there would be somewhere I could go where I wouldn't feel alone. Somewhere open and light, where I could drink a cup of coffee and read a book in a place that encouraged conversation. Which is all such self-delusional crap, because I couldn't bear to live somewhere lovely, where I would be forced to talk to people every day, a whole town of horridly nice people, smiling their sunny smiles at me when I just wanted to buy a small carton of milk without anybody asking about my weekend. I'm not lonely, I'm just alone. I choose to be alone. I know exactly what I need to do if I want to step back into society. I could watch The Wire and talk to Lance about it. Then I could offer to lend him a DVD series so that one day I could say, Do you and your wife want to come over for dinner sometime? Didn't I meet his wife once? I could say, Do you want to have a drink one night after work? To any number of people in the office. I could have said yes to that work party a few months back. I could have said yes to the people next door. I could even get on the internet and meet men who want a relationship, or at least sex. I am not socially disabled. I am reserved. Sometimes shy, but not in a debilitating way. I could do it. I did it when I moved to Sydney and I didn't know a soul. I participated. I said yes to invitations. I smiled and asked questions and made the first move. But now I can't be bothered to do it again. I'm too old and this is the crux of it. It's not fair. I shouldn't have to be in this position again. I can't bear the pretense, the fraudulent cheeriness, like when I spoke to the people next door. I would be pretending all the time, because you have to fake it in the beginning, that's the way it works. But once I had a real relationship with real friends. Once I was a mother and a wife and a friend and a daughter, and now I'm nothing. And if I moved on, if I lived a regular life, it would be like Patrick had got away with it and he was right. We weren't meant to be together. I drove to Ellen's house and my regular feeling that permanent sense of pain and loss and fury felt even worse than usual because it had disappeared for a few seconds. I was just going to leave the plastic bag with the ingredients at the front door. No need for a note. They would know they were from me. But as I was about to go back down the footpath, I saw she had a little miniature stone owl with glasses sitting up on the cornice above her door. And I thought, I bet she keeps her spare key under the owl. And I was right. Chapter 17. Don't think of a dog. You thought of a dog, didn't you? That's why it's so important to be careful with your language when you're structuring your suggestions. It's what's known as the law of reversed effect. The imagination ignores the word don't and just hears dog. Excerpt from Ellen O'Farrell's Introduction to Hypnotherapy, 2-day course. Colleen's parents came out onto their front porch as soon as Patrick drove the car into the driveway. "That's them, Frank and Millie." Patrick spoke in an odd, strained voice and waved, smiling with his teeth clenched. Jack threw open the car door and ran to his grandparents. Ellen and Patrick watched as he hugged them. It seemed like he was going to be the only one acting naturally today. "Right," said Patrick, and they got out of the car.
"Quick!"
called Millie from the doorway, beckoning to him as Jack disappeared inside with his grandfather.
"Come inside, you two, where it's nice and warm."
"Hi, Millie. Yes, good idea,"
called back Patrick in a jolly tone Ellen had never heard him use before.
"Good Lord," she thought.
"Hello?"
she cried out in a desperate rush to demonstrate to Colleen's parents she was a friendly, nice person and so very sorry for their loss. Oh God, why had she called that hello in that echoey voice? Like she was shouting to them across a mountaintop? She sounded deranged. Millie was right. The house seemed especially cozy and warm after the chilly visit to the graveyard. There was soft music playing, and Millie led Ellen to a comfortable seat right next to a log fire.
"What can I get you to drink?" she asked.
She was a tiny, bird-like woman, wearing a younger person's outfit of jeans and a white jumper that hung on her thin frame. You could see that once she'd been beautiful, and there was something about her, a look of resigned acceptance that said, "I know I'm no longer beautiful, and I couldn't care less." Her husband Frank was thin, too, and very tall, like an elderly, stooped basketball player. Ellen saw how grief had dragged at their faces, like faded claw marks. They seemed like shy people, but they were all smiles, gracious and welcoming, chatting about the traffic and the weather. It broke Ellen's heart. If only they weren't so damn nice.
"What Ellen really needs is a dry cracker," said Patrick. "She's feeling nauseous. The, pregnancy, you know."
Did she imagine that he'd lowered his voice on the word pregnancy like it was a shameful disorder?
"I'll get you one straight away," said Millie.
"I had some ready at home, but then I forgot to bring them. I'm so sorry to be a nuisance,"
Ellen babbled, as if asking for a cracker was a huge inconvenience, when what she really meant was that she was so sorry to be there at all, inconveniently alive and pregnant, taking their daughter's place.
"When I was pregnant with Colleen, I ate dry biscuits all day long," said Millie as she handed over the plate. "But then when she was pregnant with Jack, the lucky girl didn't get any nausea at all."
She smiled at her grandson.
"You were such a well-behaved baby, Jack, even before you were born."
She turned back to Ellen. "Not that I mean your own little baby isn't well-behaved." As Millie spoke, Ellen caught sight of a framed photo on the wall of Colleen holding Jack when he must have been about 6 months old. She was smiling adoringly down at him, while Jack gnawed on the leg of a toy rabbit. That's when it happened. She burst into tears, choking on her cracker, spraying crumbs, causing everyone to stare at her with alarm and astonishment.
"What are you doing?"
It was as though her body had done something unmentionable in polite company, like an explosive fart.
"Stop it,"
she ordered herself, but the tears kept sliding down her face. It was a combination of the adoration on Colleen's face in the picture, the exquisite relief of eating the cracker, the warmth of the house after the cold mountain air, Millie saying, "Your little baby," the strangeness and stress of the graveyard visit, the fact that she was meeting her father for the first time the following day. Oh, who knew what it was, except that her emotions had never embarrassed her like this before.
"Hey now," said Frank, and he came over to where she was sitting, squatted down on his long spidery legs, and rubbed her back in gentle circular motions.
Lucky Colleen to have grown up with a lovely father like Frank.
"What's wrong, Ellen?" asked Jack.
He looked to his father, but Patrick was no help. He had the stunned expression of someone whose girlfriend had just knocked over a priceless vase. He'd kept up a steady stream of conversation ever since he'd walked in the house, his voice light and chatty but with a panicky undertone, as if he was trying to distract someone from jumping off a cliff by talking about ordinary things while he waited for the police. Ellen had never seen him talk so much, and she saw that these visits were a huge effort for him, and that he was determined to ensure there were no conversational gaps or uncomfortable silences that might allow for horrible displays of grief. Now she'd upset the delicate balance he was working so hard to maintain.
"So sorry," she finally sniffed. "It must be my hormones."
Hormones, hormones, hormones. It was all she talked about lately. And yet she'd never believed in blaming her body for her behavior. She'd always believed that the mind-body connection was more likely to operate in the other direction. The mind affecting the body, not the body affecting the mind. If the client had described this irrational behavior and then tried to blame it on hormones, she would have said, in such a soothing, know-it-all tone, "I suspect this is your body's way of trying to pass on a message from your subconscious."
Patrick finally recovered enough to move over and hug her.
"You're probably just exhausted from the drive," he said, speaking in his normal voice, and the relief of feeling his arms around her and breathing in his familiar Patrick scent nearly made her cry again.
"So sorry," she said shakily. "Don't think anything of it," Frank and Millie soothed.
She worked hard to redeem herself over lunch, following Patrick's bright, chatty lead. They bounced the conversation rapidly back and forth across the table without letting it drop once, like a frantic game of hot potato. When they were ready to leave, she noticed that Frank and Millie looked drained. They probably wished the two of them had just shut up for a second.
"We hope to see you next month, my dear," said Millie, and she put her hand on Ellen's arm.
For one dreadful moment, Ellen felt more tears threatening, but she fought them back with sheer force of will. Nobody said anything as they drove out of Katoomba. Jack seemed to be slumbering in the back seat. Finally, Ellen couldn't bear it any longer.
"I'm sorry about my unexpected weeping back there," she said,
as if the word weeping would turn it into a charming, rather fascinating little incident.
"It's fine," said Patrick. "Seriously, don't worry about it."
That's where she should have left it.
"They must have found it so difficult," she said, "meeting me and the new baby."
"Yes," he said, "although, of course, you were the one doing the crying."
The sting was so sharp she caught her breath.
"I'm sorry," he said almost immediately, taking one hand off the steering wheel to reach for her. "That was meant to be a joke, a really stupid joke. Whenever I see Frank and Millie, I feel guilty for being alive when Colleen is dead. I find those visits really hard. Awkward."
"No kidding."
"Yes, I found it very awkward myself," she said.
"I sat on your dead wife's grave. These grass stains will never come out."
"I'm sorry," he said again, putting his hand back on the steering wheel. "Really, you were wonderful today. I'm so grateful to you for coming. I just wish..."
His voice drifted away, and then he stopped talking and frowned at the road ahead, as if driving now required all of his concentration.
What did he mean? "I just wish you hadn't cried? I just wish Colleen wasn't dead?"
Ellen silently boiled and bubbled with different emotions she couldn't even properly define. Shame, resentment, and something like fear.
"This is not me. I am not like this."
She broke the silence when they stopped at the red light.
"So, I guess you won't have time to move those boxes tonight." Even while she was saying it, another part of her looked on, coolly observing and shaking her head.
"Oh, Ellen, you feel guilty about embarrassing him with your tears, so this is your childish way of pointing out that he's not perfect either. You're picking a fight because you want to make something happen."
"I told you I've got to work this afternoon," he said.
"So maybe we can make next weekend the new deadline?" she said, and her tone was light and humorous, but just like his joke, it had that fine thread of steel running through the center of it.
"Don't nag me, Ellen," he said, and as she turned to look at his profile, she saw that he was clenching his jaw so tightly his cheek was hollow.
"Nagging? How am I nagging?"
"Not now, not here," he hissed, turning his head slightly to indicate Jack in the back seat, as though she deliberately picked a fight in front of his young, impressionable son. They didn't say another word for the rest of the drive home. Ellen spent the entire time reliving that weekend in the mountains with John, deliberately lingering over the memories of their lovemaking. It was the most passive-aggressive thing she'd ever done. By the time they got home, the air in the car was stuffy with silence.
"I'll see you later," said Patrick shortly, before driving off and leaving Ellen to take Jack inside. She would have to remember to cancel her coffee with Julia before she got started on homework.
"What's this?" said Ellen as she opened the screen door. There was a foil-wrapped package sitting next to the front door. She bent down and picked it up. It felt warm. Her breath quickened. Saskia. It was an impulse decision. I walked into her kitchen with the plastic bag full of ingredients, and it was like I was returning home from the supermarket. I thought, why not cook some biscuits for them? I enjoyed being in her kitchen, using her mixing bowl, her spoons, her baking trays. I have a feeling most of the things in her kitchen probably belonged to her grandmother. I remember her saying that she hadn't changed anything much when she inherited the house. I have sort of retro taste, she told me once. I'd made some remark about liking the carpet. I guess that's something we have in common, apart from Patrick, of course. I felt strangely peaceful, like I had every right to be in this house, as if I were Ellen and Patrick and Jack were out somewhere, and I was planning on surprising them with freshly baked biscuits, like I used to do when Jack was little and they went out to the park. I imagined them coming home, the sound of the key in the lock, the pounding of Jack's footsteps down the hallway. Ellen's kitchen reminded me a lot of my mother's. Perhaps that's why I felt so inappropriately comfortable, because I felt like I was in my childhood home. I remembered being a little girl, standing on a kitchen chair, one of Mum's aprons tied around my waist, helping her cook. I'd always imagined doing the same thing with my little girl one day. In fact, I did do the same thing with Jack, except I never bothered with the apron. And I didn't stand him on a chair, I just let him sit up on the benchtop next to me. He loved it. Flour in his hair, sticky fingers, eggshell in the mix. I let him use the beaters once, and he lifted them up and splattered the entire kitchen with cake mix. How would I have explained myself if they'd come home early? I know this seems strange, but I cannot bear my non-existence in your lives. If I could just move in with you, maybe. If I could just sit quietly in the corner over there and watch you live. So anyway, how was your day in the mountains? Biscuit anyone? They didn't come home, but somebody did stop by. I was just taking the biscuits out of the oven when the doorbell rang. I jumped, guiltily. I haven't completely lost my mind. I know you're not meant to walk into someone else's house and start baking biscuits. After the bell rang, someone started banging on the front door. My first thought was that it was Patrick. Something about the angry tone of the knocking, even though that didn't make sense, because why wouldn't he just walk straight in? And then I thought maybe it was the police. Someone had seen me take the key and called them. A friendly neighbor, perhaps. Ellen is the sort to have a friendly neighbor. I put down the tray and crept down the hallway, past Patrick's boxes, piled up all higgledy-piggledy. Poor Ellen. Her house doesn't have quite the same spiritual feel to it now with all these dusty boxes. I wonder if she hates it, or if she's above such earthly matters. If I know Patrick, they'll be sitting there for a long time. I looked out the side window near Ellen's front door, and I could see a man. He'd shoved his hands in his pockets and stuck his jaw out, like he was preparing for a confrontation. He was in his 40s. There was something premium-looking about him, something that said money. Maybe it was the suit, or the longish, carefully tousled haircut, or just the way he was standing with his feet firmly planted, the stance of a man who was used to being in charge. I was intrigued. A customer in need of a hypnotic fix? An ex-boyfriend of Ellen's? He didn't seem her type. I'm sure Patrick isn't her type either. He's too ordinary and blokey. She should be with a pale and interesting poet and give me back my hale and hearty surveyor. A lover? Perhaps Patrick wasn't the baby's father. That would be perfect. Could this visitor, this really quite angry-looking man, be a spanner in their works? I opened the door. Chapter 18. It's funny that people call hypnotherapy New Age. Hieroglyphics found on tombs indicate that the Egyptians were using hypnosis as early as 3000 BC. Excerpt from www.ellenofarrellhypnotherapy.com. Listen to this, Madeline. Julia put her hand on Madeline's arm and Ellen watched Madeline flinch slightly. It was Wednesday night and the three of them were out having dinner at a crowded Thai restaurant before they saw a movie. They were squashed together in a booth. The movie started at 9 p.m. and it was 7:30 now, and they'd only just managed to get their menus delivered. They were going to be late for the movie, which would irritate Madeline, while Julia would make a show of not letting it worry her, being the free and easy type that she wasn't. Julia and Madeline didn't get on, and they only pretended to like each other for Ellen's sake. As the mutual friend, Ellen normally made a point of seeing them separately, but she'd known that they both had wanted to see the new George Clooney movie, so it seemed silly not to ask the two of them. Now she reminded herself not to do it again. Julia always seemed to want to make it clear to Madeline that she was the longest-standing friend, bringing up stories from their school days, mentioning old friends and behaving in a slightly adolescent fashion. Madeline refused to take part in the I'm the better friend of Ellen competition, and instead took refuge in her role as the only mother among the three of them. She maintained a permanent, distracted, harried expression, as if she was listening out for a child's cry. At the moment, she was 8 months pregnant, so she was even worse than usual, with one hand permanently pressed to her belly. Now that Ellen was pregnant too, Madeline had the edge over Julia, and she was using it to full advantage, constantly steering the conversation back to babies. As the only one drinking, Julia was working her way through a bottle of wine and fighting back by using every opportunity to imply that she adored her child-free existence and high-flying career. Ellen wanted to grab both their hands and say, "Relax." "What?" said Madeline. She moved her hand slightly away from Julia's. She wasn't a touchy-feely sort of person. Julia, picking up on this, was always touching Madeline's arm and kissed her ostentatiously whenever they all met. "Her stalker leaves her freshly baked biscuits at her front door, and does she toss them straight in the trash and call the police like any normal, sane person would do?" said Julia. "No. She makes herself a cup of tea, and she eats them." "I hope I didn't have nuts in them," said Madeline. "You should be avoiding peanuts when you're pregnant. Did you know that?"
"Nuts are the very least of her worries," cried Julia. "The stalker would have spat in them for sure. Or worse. Oh, God, I'm gagging at the thought of what she could have done, Ellen. Of what she probably did do. Seriously."
"Well, what sort of biscuits were they?" asked Madeline.
"Shit-flavored," said Julia. She giggled so hard she keeled over sideways. Madeline shifted herself away from Julia and smiled stiffly.
"How did you know they were from her?" she asked Ellen.
From her prone position, Julia said,
"Were they chocolate chip?"
"They were Anzac biscuits, and I know they were from her because there was a note," said Ellen. "It said, 'I made these today, and I thought you might like some. Love, Saskia.'"
"Oh, that's so creepy."
Madeline shuddered with distaste to show that this sort of thing wouldn't be allowed to happen in her own orderly life.
"It gets worse," said Ellen.
"It does?"
Julia sat up again. Ellen had only given her half the story before Madeline arrived.
"I think she cooked them in my house," said Ellen.
"Oh my God," said Julia.
"What made you think that?" asked Madeline calmly, because Julia had taken on the dramatic role. "There was a smell of cooking in my kitchen," said Ellen. She remembered standing in the kitchen after that strange, awful day in the mountains, breathing in the distinctive fragrances of golden syrup and brown sugar, her heart hammering, reminded so strongly of visits when her grandmother was alive. Her grandmother used to make Anzac biscuits all the time. Saskia's had been nearly as good as hers, maybe better, crunchier.
"You might have imagined it," said Julia.
"Probably not," said Madeline. "Your sense of smell is so acute when you're pregnant. When I was having Isabella, I once smelled..."
"No crumbs?" interrupted Julia. "Or any other signs? Things moved in your cupboard?"
"The opposite of crumbs," said Ellen. "My oven was too clean. I think she cleaned it after she used it."
"Why would she come to your kitchen and cook?" mused Julia. "What point is this lunatic trying to make? What's the message she's trying to give you?"
"I hate cooking in someone else's kitchen," commented Madeline. "I can never find what I want." Julia blinked slowly at her and then turned back to Ellen.
"What did Patrick say?"
"I didn't tell him," said Ellen. "When we got back from the mountains, he had to go straight to the office. He just dropped Jack and me off. There's no point telling him. It just upsets him." She didn't tell them that she and Patrick hadn't been talking by the time they got back from the mountains.
"Did you tell Jack?" said Julia.
"I just said a friend of mine left them," said Ellen. "He wasn't that interested."
"You didn't let Jack eat them, did you?" asked Madeline.
"No," said Ellen. "I thought I'd better not. I distracted him with chocolate biscuits instead. We ate them while we did his homework."
"Biscuits before dinner,"
murmured Madeline.
But you ate them yourself. You shouldn't have even touched them, said Julia. They could have been poisoned.
Not to mention the danger to your unborn child, said Madeline. Now the two of them were nodding in complete agreement, both with serious, responsible expressions on their faces.
I know, said Ellen. I didn't even think. And they'd smelled so good. It was ironic, but she'd been upset and disconcerted by the sight of the biscuits. And then when she pulled one out and held it by her fingertips, it felt like exactly the thing she needed to make herself feel better. And then it was so good she ate another one. So eating the biscuits made her feel better for the shock of receiving them. It wasn't until after she'd eaten three in a row that it even occurred to her that they could have been poisoned. And then she'd spent the rest of the evening secretly hyperventilating and Googling things like, how long till poison takes effect.
You've been so weirdly flippant about this whole thing from the beginning, Julia spoke at the same time as she tried to catch a waiter's attention on the other side of the room. This woman came into your home. She violated your privacy. Why aren't you terrified? And why is this waiter pretending he can't see me? You can see me. Oh, yes, you can.
I don't know, said Ellen. I am a little bit terrified.
Ever since the incident with the biscuits, she'd felt a sense of slight breathlessness, as though she was running late for something important. The previous night she'd woken up just before dawn with a thought clear in her head. Something bad is going to happen.
Saskia wasn't going to stop until something happened. But what? What needed to happen?
It seemed to her that it wasn't about Saskia and Patrick anymore. It was about Saskia and Ellen. It was between the two women. And if she could just work out the right thing to do or the right words to say, maybe she could end it.
But what to say? What to do?
What?
It felt like that endless moment just after you've knocked something breakable off a table, and instead of grabbing it in midair, you freeze with one arm outstretched, and after it smashes you think, I could have stopped that from happening.
You should be completely terrified, said Madeline sternly. All the time.
Thank you so much, said Ellen. That's extremely comforting.
What I don't understand is why you haven't got the police involved, said Julia. There should be a restraining order out against her. And then each time she breaks it, you call the cops. Wham! She's in handcuffs. Problem solved.
Patrick did go to the police once, said Ellen. And he keeps talking about going again, but then he doesn't ever seem to get around to it. Also, I don't think it's quite as easy as you describe.
I've heard those restraining orders are pretty useless, agreed Madeline.
You go to the police then, ordered Julia, pointing at Ellen and ignoring Madeline.
There had been a moment when she was holding her oven mitt, her grandmother's oven mitt, thinking about the fact that Saskia had probably used it, slid her hands inside its soft cloth to protect her hands, when Ellen had been filled with outrage at the sheer audacity of this woman.
She'd marched toward the phone to call the police, but then she stopped before she even picked up the receiver.
How could she prove it?
Sniff the air, officer. Can't you smell the scent of baking? And just look how clean my oven is. I never left it that clean. She would have looked like a fool.
And besides, it was up to Patrick, and for whatever reason, he still wasn't ready to get the police involved.
She's never showed any signs of being violent, she said feebly.
Not yet, said Madeline. You do realize she's going to turn up at your wedding, said Julia. When the priest says, if anyone here present knows of any reason why these two should not be joined in holy matrimony, she'll pipe up, oh, me.
I don't think they actually say that anymore, said Ellen. Julia talked over the top of her.
She'll come charging down the aisle saying, I'm the reason.
She might bring a gun, said Madeline enthusiastically.
You'll have to wear a bulletproof vest under your gown, said Julia.
I don't think I'll bring my children, mused Madeline.
Said Ellen. This was why she and Patrick hadn't gotten very far with their wedding plans. Every time they started talking about it, the conversation came back to Saskia.
Even if we go overseas, she'll probably track us down, Patrick had said.
He seemed relieved when Ellen suggested perhaps they should just wait until after the baby was born, even though his mother would probably have kittens about the child being born out of wedlock. Ellen's nausea wasn't making her feel very bridal anyway.
You must hate her, said Madeline. I hate her on your behalf. You can't even plan your own wedding.
I don't hate her, said Ellen. Not really. I'd actually quite like to talk to her.
Yes, good idea. Ask your stalker out for coffee, guffawed Julia.
Ring her up now and ask her to join us at the movies, said Madeline, with a quick, shy grin at Julia. Julia laughed harder than was necessary. They were bonding over Ellen's foolishness.
I might ring her one day, said Ellen thoughtfully. She stirred her glass of mineral water with her straw and watched the bubbles. I just might.
Ever since Sunday, I've been thinking about the man who came to Ellen's house.
Ellen O'Farrell, he said, and sort of lunged at me when I opened the door.
I stepped back and kept the screen door shut.
No, I said. She's not here.
Okay, who are you?
He had the tone of someone who demands and receives the very best service. He reminded me of the developers I deal with at work. Men who are so very, very sure of their place in the world.
Well, who are you? I said quite snootily, which is funny, seeing as I was actually the intruder.
I'm someone who needs to talk to her, he said. His nostrils flared. Urgently.
I could give her a message, I offered, imagining a jaunty little note left on a post-it on her fridge. Angry man drop by who needs to see you urgently. Love, Saskia.
Don't bother. He looked like he was trying hard not to punch a wall. I'll come back another time.
You do that, I said spiritedly. And then he left. It was strange, but as I closed the door, I actually felt defensive on Ellen's behalf. There's something so guileless about her, like she believes everyone is as sweet and sincere as she, when clearly we're not. Also, I had a strong feeling I knew that man from somewhere. I just couldn't quite remember where.
So what was it like meeting the dead wife's family? Asked Julia. Her cheeks were flushed from all the wine she was drinking, and she'd rubbed her eyes so her mascara was faintly smudged, giving her a sexily disheveled look. In the restaurant's shadowy mood lighting, she looked the way she had when Ellen and she used to take their fake IDs so they could go out drinking together in high school during their not especially impressive, short-lived rebellious phase. Her mother and godmothers had got up to much worse when they were teenagers.
Oh, but wait, I want to hear about meeting your dad.
Madeline sat back and laced her hands together under her breasts and across the top of her big belly. As she moved, Ellen's elbow bumped against the firm flesh of her belly, and she was shocked by the reality of Madeline's baby. There was an actual baby just centimeters away from Ellen's elbow. Not just the idea of a baby. A real live baby curled up under the striped fabric of Madeline's maternity top and the stretched skin of her stomach. Ellen laced her own hands together in imitation of Madeline and placed them across her own stomach, which was still soft and only faintly, implausibly rounded, as if she'd just been enjoying a few too many pizzas. Her clothes were starting to feel tighter, but it was impossible to imagine that in a few months she'd have an enormous stomach like Madeline's, one that would give her that characteristic pregnant sway-back gait, one that would cause people to smile and offer a chair and ask, "How much longer now?"
"Her life is like a soap opera these days, isn't it?" said Julia.
"Like sand through the hourglass, so are the days of Ellen's lives," intoned Madeline in quite a good American accent. Ellen had never heard her put on a voice before to make a joke.
"Remember when she was so calm and zen? Nothing messy ever happened to her?" said Julia.
"That's not true," protested Ellen. "I had messy relationship breakups."
"No, even your breakups seem to happen on a higher level of existence than the rest of us," said Madeline.
"That makes me sound annoying," said Ellen. She was hurt. It was like she had overheard a conversation that revealed what her friends really thought of her. Julia and Madeline were too busy liking each other for the first time to notice.
"Oh, not that annoying. Anyway, me first," said Julia. "The wife's family?"
"Maybe we should just concentrate on eating quickly and efficiently," said Ellen, as a waiter appeared at their table with three giant plates balanced on his forearm.
"Let's skip the movie," said Madeline. "Let's just relax."
"Excellent idea." Julia settled back in the booth and smiled at Madeline. Watching them talking to the waiter, confirming what each dish was, leaning back politely to let him spoon out their rice, Ellen saw for the first time that the two of them were actually quite similar. Their carefully relaxed demeanors hid a fragile defensiveness,
as if they expected to be criticized at any moment and they weren't going to stand for it. They both seemed to cling so hard to their chosen personalities. I am this sort of person, and therefore I believe this, I think this, I do this, and I am right. I'm right, I'm sure I'm right. Although then again, maybe everybody did that to some extent. Perhaps all grown-ups were just children carefully putting on their grown-up disguises each day and then acting accordingly. Perhaps it was a necessary part of being a grown-up. Or perhaps it was just that Ellen felt herself to have a more nebulous, less defined sort of personality than both Madeline and Julia. Or perhaps this was all a load of rubbish, and Madeline and Julia were just being themselves. Lately, Ellen was becoming increasingly impatient with the way she never just accepted anything at face value. She couldn't quite understand her impatience. It was like she'd suddenly turned against a dear old friend for no good reason.
It must have been so awkward, said Madeline, meeting Patrick's old in-laws.
Do you think they hated you? Asked Julia, replacing their beloved daughter.
They were lovely, said Ellen. They seemed perfectly relaxed about it, but I made a fool of myself.
Oh, no, said Julia, as though Ellen was in the habit of making a fool of herself.
What did you do?
I saw a photo on the wall of Colleen holding Jack when he was a baby, and I...
You criticized her, said Julia. You spoke ill of the dead.
Julia was terrified of death. Whenever she was confronted with it, she became skittish and weird, as if she could somehow ward it off.
Does that sound like something I'd do? Said Ellen, as she lifted her spoon to her mouth.
Shellfish!
Screeched Madeline and knocked the spoon from Ellen's mouth.
It's not!
Ellen indicated the plate in front of her.
It's the chicken!
Oh, sorry, you're right, said Madeline. Carry on. Anyway, I think this whole thing with what you can and can't eat when you're pregnant has gone too far, said Ellen. The French still eat soft cheeses and drink wine. The Japanese still eat sushi, and their babies are all fine. Madeline pursed her lips as if she wasn't quite convinced about the quality of French and Japanese babies. I wouldn't be taking any risks in the first trimester. Julia's face closed down slightly at the pregnancy talk.
So what did you do when you saw the photo?
I cried, said Ellen.
You cried? You didn't even know the girl.
Madeline put down her fork as though she'd just tasted something disgusting. She was clearly mortified on Ellen's behalf.
Why would you cry? Asked Julia with interest.
Pregnancy hormones, said Madeline wisely. Although you can't spend the next 6 months behaving like that. Couldn't you, I don't know, hypnotize yourself or something? It was clear just how seriously Madeline was taking this that she'd suggest self-hypnosis. Ellen knew that Madeline thought hypnotherapy was a load of New Age nonsense, a waste of people's time and money, quackery, plain silly, misguided but well-meaning. She didn't know which actual phrases Madeline would use, but she knew from the carefully polite blank expression that crossed Madeline's face whenever Ellen's career came up that it would be something along those lines. Ellen had never pushed because she knew Madeline would lie to be polite, and she'd lie badly, and Ellen didn't see the need to make her uncomfortable. She knew that Madeline was fond of her and that she would never want to hurt Ellen's feelings. Up until now, Ellen hadn't minded the lack of balance in their conversation. In fact, she'd enjoyed a slightly superior feeling about her maturity in the face of Madeline's prejudice. Her sense of self-worth didn't rely on other people's approval. But now she felt a powerful surge of resentment. Her work was important to her. It was a huge part of her life. Why hadn't Madeline at least tried to learn more about hypnotherapy? She'd never even asked a single question about her work. What was that about? It was disrespectful. In fact, it was infuriating.
Have I got something in my teeth? Asked Madeline, flustered.
She turned to the mirrored wall. Why are you staring at me like that? Ellen cleared her throat. It would not be appropriate to suddenly shriek,
Why have we never talked about my job, Madeline?
What was wrong with her lately? Pregnancy seemed to be stripping away all her emotional maturity. She had all these new, raw, out-of-control feelings. Moments of pure fury followed by hopeless despair. Good Lord, she was behaving like a client. Sorry, Ellen smiled at Madeline to make up for her silent shrieking. I drifted off.
Well, I think there must have been more to it than just hormones, said Julia. Did it make you feel guilty, knowing that you were having a baby with her husband? Of course, you're the expert on repressed feelings.
Ellen gave Julia a grateful look. Unlike Madeline, Julia had always been supportive and proud of Ellen's work. Over the years, she'd referred dozens of friends and acquaintances to her. Yes, she was a dear, dear friend.
"Are you crying now?" asked Julia. "Just remembering it?"
"No, sorry, I just..." Ellen began to giggle hopelessly. She saw Julia and Madeline exchange looks.
"I know pregnant women go a bit crazy," said Julia, "but isn't this excessive?"
"Yes," said Madeline.
"I hate to think what you did when you met your father for the first time," said Julia. "You must have needed a sedative."
She put the back of her hand to her forehead.
"Daddy, Daddy, my long-lost Daddy!"
Madeline chortled and then looked guilty. "Although I guess maybe meeting your father probably was quite emotional, was it?"
"Actually," said Ellen, "I had the opposite problem. I felt nothing. Absolutely nothing."
"Really?"
Madeline looked relieved. That was more like it.
"He was just a man," said Ellen. "A dull, ordinary man, like your dentist or your accountant. Receding hairline, glasses. I just didn't find him that interesting."
"Poor Daddy," said Julia into her wine glass. "You know what I really want to talk about?"
Ellen put down her knife and fork.
"Boxes. Boxes clogging up my hallway."
"That doesn't sound especially interesting," said Julia.
"They're Patrick's, right?"
Madeline immediately grasped the situation.
"Yes," said Ellen.
"I asked and asked and he won't move them. It's driving me crazy. How do you make a man do something without nagging?"
"That," said Madeline, "is the billion-dollar question."
"I was watching the late news tonight when it suddenly came to me. I knew exactly who that man was. So what did he want with Ellen, and why was he so angry with her?"
Ellen sat in the car in the dark without turning the keys in the ignition and luxuriated in the sudden silence after the noisy babble in the restaurant. Her ears were buzzing and she felt overstimulated, as if she'd just been having a crazy drunken night out at the nightclub, not a sedate, alcohol-free dinner with two old friends. For some reason, she had found Julia and Madeline a little overwhelming tonight. Their faces in that crowded booth had been so close to hers. Julia's fine-boned face with the surprising lines around the eyes, surprising because Ellen would always think of her as a 14-year-old schoolgirl, and Madeline's plumper, softer features with the upturned nose and the rosebud lips. Ellen could still smell Julia's perfume and hear the rhythms of Madeline's slightly hoarse voice. She had the beginnings of a cold.
"I'm seeing Sam tomorrow night,"
Julia had said to her as they stood on the pavement outside the restaurant after Madeline had hurried off.
"Stinky? He really did have the flu that time. I knew it.
You've been seeing him. Why didn't you tell me earlier?"
"We don't call him that," said Julia.
"Anyway, don't get all excited and start planning cozy little double dates. We're just friends."
Ellen could see hope shining bright in Julia's eyes.
"Stop it," said Julia when she saw the expression on Ellen's face. "Not a word."
But her arms tightened around Ellen when she hugged her goodbye. Now Ellen glanced at her watch. As they'd skipped the movie, it was only 9:30. There was a good chance Jack would still be up when she got home. He seemed to stay up very late for an 8-year-old, but what did she know? She knew that Patrick would be entirely respectful if she was to suggest that Jack's bedtime be changed, but she felt so self-conscious when it came to parenting this self-sufficient little boy, as if she was just play-acting. She should have asked Madeline what time her children went to bed. She would have set her straight. It was so nice not to be going home to an empty house. The lights would be blazing as she pulled up in the driveway. When she opened the door, there would be the smell of tacos or popcorn or some other late-night snack. Patrick and Jack would be watching television together or playing some game on the Wii or chasing each other through the house, brandishing the branch that had once hung on her ceiling to remind her to practice mindfulness and had now somehow become a sword or a laser gun or something. They seemed so violent sometimes. Patrick would ask about the movie. Jack would want to tell her something about his day. They would have hot chocolate and some of the fundraiser chocolates Jack was meant to be selling for school. Patrick would tell Jack to go to bed about 20 times, and he finally would. Yes, it was so very nice to be going home to the hubbub of the family life she'd always wanted.
but she still didn't turn the key in the ignition.
Fine. Think it out loud, Ellen. It would also be quite nice to be going home to an empty house, to calming silence and a hallway free of boxes, to a cup of tea with a book, to a long hot bath without anyone asking if she was coming to bed soon. It would be lovely, in fact, the way she was feeling right now, to have her own house to herself, to have her own bed to herself, to have her old life back for just tonight. She thought of all those nights over the last year when she'd come home alone and she'd fumbled in the dark with her key to unlock the door, and as she fumbled, she'd longed for someone to be waiting inside for her, someone exactly like Patrick. She thought about Saskia, so single-minded in her desire to have Patrick back. She'd held on for all those years. She was an attractive, intelligent woman. She could have met plenty of other men, but she only wanted Patrick. It might be crazy, but it was committed. Ellen knew that she didn't love Patrick with that same ferocity. Actually, she'd never loved anyone that much. She would never break into anyone's house. She'd never be so overcome by a feeling that she'd break a law or do anything that was socially unacceptable. She could hear Julia and Madeline saying, "That's a good thing, you fool. That's sanity. That's maturity." She sighed and reached out to turn the key in the ignition, and then she dropped her hand back in her lap. A young couple walked by on the pavement outside the car. They were arguing over something. Suddenly the girl turned on her heel and walked away, making a flicking motion with her hand. The boy watched her go. "Follow her," thought Ellen. "That's what she wants you to do." But he clenched his jaw, shrugged, shoved his hands in his pockets, and walked away from her. She thought about everything she'd said to her friends at dinner that night, and everything she'd left out. All those years she'd sanctimoniously told clients that relationships are hard work. She'd never truly understood the truth of what she was saying. In fact, she'd probably secretly thought that relationships were hard work for other people, not for her. Not with her knowledge and skills and emotional intelligence. Oh, the conceit. She and Patrick had made up after their trip to the mountains, of course, later that night. The relief was exquisite, almost worth the argument. "It was my fault," Ellen had said nobly. "It was absolutely my fault," said Patrick. And he'd explained about a problem he was having at work, a client who was refusing to pay a big bill. Also, he'd seen Saskia waiting outside in her car when they left for the mountains. Patrick said, "I think I was subconsciously taking out my stress on you." He was trying his best to speak her language, which was sort of adorable. Then he'd been horrified to learn that she had to cancel her coffee with Julia to stay home with Jack. "Why didn't you tell me?" he said. "That's crazy."
"I don't know," said Ellen. "I guess I just wanted to be like a proper mother."
"You are a proper mother," said Patrick. "I love the way you are with him. You couldn't be any better. I should never have assumed you were free."
"Well, I guess I should have told you earlier."
"Shut up, woman. I'm taking the fall for this one," said Patrick, and he'd spent the next 20 minutes rubbing her feet. There was no way she was going to mention Saskia's biscuits then. The foot rubbing would have ended instantly while he paced and fretted and swore. And later that night, on the day of the trip to the mountains, he'd actually moved two of the boxes. He dragged them into the dining room, leaving what looked like tire marks of a monster truck right across her grandmother's carpet. Ellen had a vision of her grandmother's horror-struck face, remembering all the time she'd spent on her hands and knees scrubbing away at some tiny spot visible only to her eyes.
"Sorry, Grandma."
The rest of the boxes were still there. They had a settled, slumped look about them now. It was becoming impossible to imagine them moved. Now she turned on the ignition and switched on the headlights, illuminating the street in front of her. The boy she'd seen earlier was running back along the street, his chin down, his arms pumping like he was on a football field. Yes! Ellen felt a tingle. He was running back after his girlfriend to swoop her up into his arms and bury his face in her hair. How lovely. Or perhaps he was going back to knock her teeth out. Life wasn't always as romantic as it seemed. She pulled out into the traffic. Like, for example, you would think that meeting your father for the first time ever would be an occasion filled with tender, tremulous emotion. Monday lunchtime had been such a mistake. Why in the world had she thought that daytime would be better than night? It was so obvious that dinner would have been more appropriate. They had ended up meeting at a cafe in North Sydney because all three of them had various appointments around the area that day, and it seemed to make sense. The problem was that it made the lunch feel like just another appointment in their day, an errand to be crossed off their list. They were making small talk like business acquaintances do before someone takes out their notepad and says, "Right, let's get started." Also, the lighting was all wrong. It was too sunny and real. She didn't want to notice the minuscule black dots of hair on her father's upper lip. She didn't want to see the pores on his nose, or the glimpses of pink mottled scalp beneath his hair. She didn't want to see the sauce from his Moroccan chicken wrap on his lip. She certainly didn't want to see her mother gaily wiping it away with her serviette. Her mother, so soft and accommodating and feminine. At one point in the conversation, she'd actually fiddled with her hair. Ellen's nausea hadn't helped either. It really colored the way she saw the world. A horrible beige color. It seemed to get better at night. Why hadn't she remembered that? When she'd walked into the cafe, it had reminded her of internet dating, that intensely peculiar feeling of searching the room for the face of a stranger whom you were imagining as a potential life partner. Could I imagine kissing you, waking up with you, arguing with you? Except that there was no escape clause with this meeting, because it didn't actually matter what she thought of him. She wouldn't be able to go back online and choose another potential father. Her eyes had skimmed right past him at first. He was just another one of the ubiquitous, grey-haired businessmen in good suits who filled the cafe. And then she saw her mother sitting opposite him. She almost hadn't recognized her. She was used to seeing her mother with Mel and Pip, the three of them making a minor spectacle of themselves, talking and laughing louder than anyone else. Her mother seemed somehow diminished sitting opposite this grey-haired man. Instead of sitting back in her chair, with perfect posture like a queen, she was leaning forward, both her forearms resting on the table, her head tilted at a subservient angle. When she saw Ellen, she sat up abruptly as if she'd been caught doing something wrong, and then she smiled and waved, and Ellen saw pride, followed almost instantaneously by fear, cross her face. David, her father, stood up as Ellen walked toward them and kissed her graciously on both cheeks, in the way that men of a certain age and income level did these days. "The kissing thing has got out of control in this city lately," Madeline had said tonight at dinner. "Next thing you know, you'll have to kiss the checkout chick goodbye as you're picking up your groceries." "It's a pleasure to meet you, Ellen," he'd said. And then as they sat down, he said more formally, "You're a very welcome surprise in my life." But at the moment he said it, a waitress appeared, talking over the top of him, tossing down laminated menus on their table, and then he obviously wasn't sure if Ellen had heard him, and he didn't know if he should say it again. And Ellen was too busy asking if the waitress could bring some plain bread as quickly as possible, please, so the moment passed for her to reassure him and to say that he was a welcome surprise in her life, too. That tiny little moment of social awkwardness had caused his urbane facade to slip a little, and that had given her the squirmy feeling of seeing something she shouldn't have seen, as though she'd suddenly noticed that he was wearing a toupee. After that, they'd stuck to the small talk. They chatted about the weekend away in the Whitsundays. Glorious, amazing. Her mother's voice was so shrill. She sounded like someone else's mother. And the play they'd seen, about what it was like for David to be living back in Sydney after all these years. He was an orthopedic surgeon and planned to practice only for a few more years before he retired. "Then I might buy a boat and sail around the world for a year," he said. He looked at Anne. "Fancy being my first mate?" Anne glowed. "As long as there's an espresso machine on board." Every now and then Ellen would think, "These are my parents. I'm out having lunch with my parents." She imagined meeting a friend or a client, someone who didn't know her history. "This is my mum and dad." How extraordinarily ordinary. Her father had asked her lots of searching questions about hypnotherapy, with elaborately casual references to articles he'd recently read. It was obvious that he'd spent some time researching hypnotherapy specifically for this meeting, which was touching, almost painfully so. Ellen got a prickling sensation behind her eyes as he listened so courteously and attentively to her answers. It was also obvious that he was relatively open-minded on the subject of alternative therapies, especially for a surgeon of his age and background. Her mother didn't make any of her normal sharp comments. She even made some vaguely complimentary remarks. Ellen often has a waiting list, you know, she told David, and after a few minutes in a doctor-to-doctor tone. Apparently she's had some quite good results with idiopathic pain management. Although you've never once referred a patient to me, Mum. Did her mother feel she needed to sell Ellen to him? As if Anne was a single mother and her kid was part of the package? Like Jack was part of Patrick's package. David spoke about his two sons with a father's casual tenderness. Just using their names caused him to smile involuntarily. Do they have children yet? Asked Ellen.